Support for this KQED podcast comes from Walmart Labs, based in Silicon Valley. Powered by its own open source technology, Walmart Labs engineers code in an agile DevOps environment. Learn more about engineering and big data positions at walmartlabs.com.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, U.S. Congresswoman Barbara Lee recently helped launch an economic initiative aimed at keeping minority and women-owned businesses in Oakland. As a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, she's also taken up issues of social justice, affordable housing, HIV/AIDS prevention, and increasing diversity in Silicon Valley. The Congresswoman, whose 13th district stretches from San Leandro to Berkeley, will join us in studio for our opening hour, and that's next. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. We're joined for this morning's opening forum hour by veteran East Bay Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who represents the 13th Congressional District here in California and who joins us in studio. And I ought to mention that there is much going on in the stock market, and we'll talk about that as we begin our second hour with our guest, Ken Dykewald. But we're going to talk with Barbara Lee about a whole range of things here. And welcome to the program. Good to have you back.
Happy to be with you, Michael.
Let's start off talking about Cuba, because you were behind the scenes and you were rallying and you were working very much to see that this was brought into fruition. And I know that you're rather pleased with what's going on. Any ambivalent feelings? Especially I was thinking maybe when John Kerry got up and said those things on national television in Cuba about human rights. What were your thoughts?
Well, first, I don't have any ambivalent feelings about normalizing relations with the country 90 miles away from our shores. The first time I visited Cuba was probably 1976, 1977. I've been there over 20 times now. And the reason I continue to go and take people with me, generally I'm part of a delegation or I'm leading a delegation, is because I think the people of our country need to understand the realities of Cuban society, Cuban government, and need to come back and be advocates for normalizing the relations, ending the embargo, and ending the travel ban. And I've been doing this for many, many years. I actually was involved in helping the negotiations around the release of Alan Gross and the Cuban Five. So fast forward to where we are now, we haven't completely lifted the embargo nor the travel ban. It takes legislation to do that. And so myself, I'm co-sponsor of two bills with Republicans to lift the travel ban and lift the embargo.
Marco Rubio is not one of those Republicans.
No, but let me tell you, most members of Congress, I think if those bills came to the floor today, we'd get them passed. The speaker, however, is caught up in the very right-wing stance, and that's living 54 years in the past. And because of that, he won't move forward on this
bill. Is that a right-wing stance, or is that money coming in to the Republican Party coffers from, well, those who are opposed to Castro?
Well, it can't be that much money at this point, because when you look at Florida and when you look at the Cuban-American population, young Cubans, Cuban-Americans are going down to Cuba every day. They're sending remittances. They're visiting their families, and they're coming back to America. And so and all of the polls show that most Cuban Americans want the embargo lifted and the travel ban lifted. And so I think this is about five or six members of Congress who are stuck in the past for a variety of reasons. Some have personal reasons about property, you know, being confiscated. I mean, there are all kinds of issues that they have, which I respect. But I think the public, we have, what, 65-70% of the American public, the Cuban public, people want to have normal relations. And of course, it's going to be challenging because we have a lot of issues we want to deal with.
I think it's inevitable.
With the Cubans. Yeah. And the Cubans have issues they want to deal with us.
What about Guantanamo, though? How does that figure into this?
That's part of it. You know, but you can't even have Guantanamo on the table if you're not in dialogue and if you're not in a normal kind of diplomatic bilateral relationship. And so moving forward, we are getting to that point. And so I'm sure Guantanamo, like other issues, are going to be on the table for negotiations. And we've got to be real and understand that this has to be a respectful relationship and a respectful dialogue and know that the Cubans have issues they want to raise with us, and we have issues we want to raise with the Cubans.
The president wants to close down Guantanamo still? I mean, it was a promise, in fact, with his campaign.
It was a promise, and it should be closed. There were those in Congress, however, Democrats and Republicans, who stopped that. I believe the president is going to be able to close Guantanamo. It's a matter of time, and it's a matter of a strategy, and it's a matter of trying to figure out how to do it. Quite frankly, I believe through executive action, because I don't think we're going to see much passed in Congress that's going to allow for that.
What about the Iran deal? You're going to get that through too, you think?
This Iran deal, I think, is the best deal that we could hope for. It's a good deal. And I'm part of the whip team, and I want to commend Leader Pelosi, because she's been very clear and very strong on how we as Democrats, and hopefully some Republicans, it doesn't look like it, but how we need to vote for the deal. And should the no vote pass in terms of trying to say no to the deal, hopefully we have the votes to sustain a veto. And I'm working very hard to be sure we can do that. And so is Leader Pelosi. She's leading this effort. And it's quite amazing how for the last couple of years, and oftentimes people don't remember this, but Iran has stopped enriching uranium. For 2 years now, we've been safer than we were 2 years ago, and this was during the negotiations. And no one is looking at Iran through rose-colored glasses. We understand Iran and know what the threats are, but we don't want to see Iran with a nuclear weapon. I've been so involved in the nuclear nonproliferation efforts over many, many years, and I think this is the best deal we can get. It does put the nuclear program to a halt, and hopefully the public will understand this and support our leader, Pelosi, and the president.
A lot of people admire you for your stance with the Iraq War, for your stance with respect to some of the legislation that was pretty much a part of the design of the Bush administration. Wondering, any regrets or any consequences for the stand that you took, which was a very brave stand by any standards?
No regrets. Quite frankly, what you're talking about is the vote against the blank check that the Congress gave to President Bush or any subsequent president 3 days after the horrific attacks on our country. And this resolution, Michael, was so broad. It said, and I'm paraphrasing now, but it said the president is authorized to use force against any nation, organization, individual responsible for 9/11, connected to 9/11, or any terrorist group anywhere in the world forever. Now, this resolution has been used over 30-some times, which I asked Congressional Research Service to document, and this is non-classified information, 30-some times in Yemen, Somalia. It's used for detentions. It's used for drone attacks. This resolution was so broad, any president at any time can use it for any area of the world to conduct force or to use whatever
mechanisms. Which is why you opposed it. Yeah.
That's why I opposed it. Yeah. But let me tell you, I was the only one who opposed it in 2001, but now I'm trying to repeal it. And my last vote to repeal it, I believe I had over 160 votes to repeal it. So coming from 1 to 160 is quite phenomenal, because the people in our country understand that this state of perpetual war can't go on. If we're going to continue to use force, you have to have congressional authorization to do that. You just can't keep using a blank check to use force in perpetuity. So now we're building support to repeal it. I don't have enough votes yet, but we have to get to 218, so elections are so important. But it's quite amazing to see every time I offer the amendment or the resolution, we're building support to repeal that, and it's got to be repealed.
You took so much heat then, though, didn't you?
I took a lot of heat.
Yeah.
It was very dangerous, and we still have those to deal with. You know, there's a lot of anger out there. A lot of people were confused, Michael, about the right to dissent in our country, which really shocked me, because central to any democracy, especially ours, is if you don't agree with what your government is doing, you have that right and that duty to say no and to dissent. And there were many, many people who just were so angry because I said no. But that's what we have to deal with. And that's what we have to do in terms of educating people. We have, if there's something that, especially if it's constitutionally sound, and if you believe it's the right constitutional position to take And if you think that you were elected to represent the right thing to do, then you've got to do that. And it's not easy, believe you me. But that was a moment in time when I could not go with the flow.
We have Mr. Trump now talking about doing away with one of the constitutional amendments, and he seems to be getting a lot of the heartland behind him. Talk for a moment just about the race here. Are you essentially casting your fate with Secretary Clinton, or would you like to see Joe Biden in the race, or what's happening from your perspective?
Well, I think Secretary Clinton is doing a great job in terms of her campaign. Of course, a lot of the issues that she has to deal with, she's dealing with, I think, very aggressively and forthrightly. I have not endorsed anyone in the race because I think that Bernie Sanders is really doing a good job in terms of laying out the issues, in terms of galvanizing the progressive community. And I think it's very important that those of us who are progressive allow this movement to develop without getting involved necessarily with an endorsement so early. But I do believe that she's going to be our nominee. And I do believe that the progressive community will want to support her. And I'm going to get involved when I think is the right time to encourage a get out, because we need a strong get out to vote effort with Democrats. And I'm definitely going to be working very hard to make sure.
Our guest, by the way, is Congresswoman Barbara Lee, representing California's 13th District, which includes Oakland. And Oakland has 4,000 people on a waiting list for subsidized child care. I'm sure you're well aware of this because I know it's been a major issue for you. 1,000 more in the surrounding cities like Berkeley and Albany, Emeryville. You're doing something about this. What can be done about this?
First thing we need to do is understand that child care, early childhood education and child care should be part of a strategy in terms of universal early childhood development. And we need to fully fund Head Start. We need to fully fund universal preschool. I'm on the Appropriations Committee, and we're under what is called now sequester, where we're living in really a state of austerity. And because of that, budgets have been cut in the most important areas, such as in education and in school. And they've been cut as it relates to child care and early childhood development. And so what I have to do and what we're trying to do is make sure we eliminate and get rid of sequester so that we can begin to fully fund those 4,000 slots that we need, those 4,000 children that we need slots for.
And what's the likelihood of that with a dominated Republican Congress?
Well, some Republicans, like Chairman Rogers, the chair of the Appropriations Committee, continues to say he wants sequester lifted. We can't live in these austerity and austere times. But yeah, well, they won't do anything to lift it. The president has vowed now to veto every appropriations bill, which most of them I don't support because they're so bad, because they're way down at the funding, you know, in terms of the funding levels. We can't do anything with the funding levels as they are. So the president's going to veto those bills. And hopefully that will help the Republicans understand that they've got to come to the table and start looking at funding levels that make a heck of a lot of sense, make more sense so that we can fund child care. I raised two sons as a single mom. And Michael, I'm going to tell you, it was really hard then in the 70s to get quality child care. And I didn't have any money and I had to take my kids with me. I went to Mills College to school. I found finally a couple of child care centers. One was Rose Street Daycare Center in Berkeley, and I was on public assistance. And fortunately, they had a sliding fee scale, and I was able to put my kids there. And what that did for me was amazing because I knew those kids had good child care, but also early childhood education. They were being educated at the same time. It wasn't just babysitting. Last week, I visited a child care center in my district, and it was phenomenal what this young lady is doing with kids. But they need resources. They need more money. We need more slots, and kids deserve this.
We're talking with Congresswoman Barbara Lee about a whole range of issues. And when you talk about what kids need, I know you've been active in the attempt to get more diversity in Silicon Valley. And this is particularly something that's been part of the Congressional Black Caucus, high on the list. In fact, there's a Tech 2020 initiative now that's in the works and so forth, and been asking for transparency. Some have been cooperative, some have not been so cooperative, but there was talk with Tim Cook of Apple. There was talk with Brian Krasnick of Intel. I think it's the latest figures I saw were 7% Apple and 2% Google, for example, which, you know, are pretty minuscule in the grand scheme of things. But Dr. Clarence Jones, whom I know you know, whom we both know, was in fact an advisor to Reverend Martin Luther King, said you have to start the pipeline really early. You have to go to the elementary schools and everything. We got an education crisis, too. I think he's right, isn't he?
He's absolutely correct. And Dr. Jones, he's a phenomenal individual. We actually visited the King Institute on Stanford's campus during our tech tour, where Dr. King's papers are housed. And, of course, Clarence is there with Dr. Carson. Minimal resources, but they're preserving Dr. King's legacy in a way that I hope people understand and really support. The tech companies, I co-chair Tech 2020 for the Congressional Black Caucus, and we visited five. We're going to visit some more in New York. We'll be back to Silicon Valley. We've been working with Reverend Jackson to make sure that the transparency is there in terms of disclosing the numbers. And we have to do more. They have to do more. Some of them are way ahead of others. I think Apple, Tim Cook, they're doing a phenomenal job, and they have a commitment to do more and do better. No one is saying everything is perfect at any of these companies, but Intel is doing a great job. And I think what's important to recognize is you've got to start with children and STEM education early, and many of our public schools don't offer that. And so these tech companies are they need to do more in terms of investing in early childhood education and in grammar school, as well as in historically black colleges and universities and at the college level. But let me tell you, not all of these jobs are STEM jobs. Over 40% are tech jobs. 40% plus are not non-tech related. You have services, you have accountants, you have lawyers, you have non-tech jobs, which people of color, African Americans, qualify for. But for whatever reason, they have not been able to break into that industry. For many, many years, I've been working on this because I have constituents in Oakland who are well-qualified African-American engineers for these jobs, and they're not hired. And so you have now, thank goodness Facebook has done this, the unconscious bias kind of surveys within their organizations to determine how people view people of color when they come in to get a job. And so you've got to see this in many, many ways. One is the discrimination that is taking place, primarily, maybe, unconscious biases. But secondly, the investment in STEM education for young people so that they're ready to go into the tech sector. And we've got to make sure that the non-tech jobs are filled with people of color and who have the qualifications to do these jobs. I mean, it's ridiculous that in Silicon Valley you have companies with 2%, 3%, 5% African-American employee workforce. Very few invest in startup venture capital companies. So there are many, many contracts available, suppliers who could be doing business with these tech companies. Very few are African-American or Latino. So it's a big piece that we're working on. And I think that the tech companies in good faith want to do the right thing. I know the Black Caucus certainly wants to cooperate with them, but we've got to keep the push there. And Reverend Jackson has done a phenomenal job also.
Since you mentioned we're talking about the Black Caucus, there was when the Ferguson grand jury came in with essentially a decision in Darren Wilson to not indict. The Black Caucus said this was a slap in the face. There was a lot of anger and indignation, understandably so. I'm wondering now, what kind of force does something like that have? Or what do you, I mean, and particularly in terms of, we did a show recently with some of the Black Lives Matter people and been talking a lot about this and so forth. How does a Congressional Black Caucus tie in with that growing movement? A growing movement, by the way, which I ought to add, has gone, you mentioned Bernie Sanders earlier, you know, has confronted him and recently confronted Hillary Clinton, interestingly enough, Democrats, about their concerns and making their concerns relevant to those candidates and getting those candidates to answer. They're not doing it with the Republicans, by the way. They're doing it with the Democrats. Yeah.
Well, it's very important that the Congressional Black Caucus continue with this work. For example, in Ferguson, members of the CBC went to Ferguson and held a couple of town meetings to listen to determine what people in Ferguson thought we should do. As a result of that, some of us raised money to help elect new candidates that were more diverse to their boards and city councils. So elections are very important in terms of diversity, in terms of having people in public office.
Ferguson has moved forward on that
score. Understood, yeah. And so the Black Caucus was very instrumental and helpful in that. Beyond that, there are many, many bills that we have been working on for years, not just now, but Ferguson really gave us a chance to move these this legislation forward in a public way so that people could rally around it. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One is we introduced the Police Accountability Act. That's H.R. 1102, which wants to expand the DOJ's ability to investigate police wrongdoing and makes it a federal crime for a police officer to commit murder or manslaughter. That's one bill. Next one is, of course, the Stop Militarization Law Enforcement Act. That's H.R. 1232, which restricts the 1033 program that puts surplus weapons of war, you know, from Iraq and Afghanistan into the hands of local police forces with the requirement that they be used within a year. And I've for a long time now, I've wondered why this was taking place. But after Ferguson, we started looking at it. And this is new legislation that I'm a co-sponsor of, sponsored by Congressman Hank Jones out of Georgia. So we introduced that after we saw the weapons in Ferguson being used in the streets. I mean, those weapons of war don't belong.
They're military weapons.
In America on the streets. Also, you know, there's a whole package of bills which we'd be happy to send to anyone who would like to see what policy initiatives the Black Caucus has mounted as a result of our Ferguson Task Force, which I serve on. But grand jury reform, for example, diversity in the police force.
If you can have someone from your office send them to us, we'll put them on mm-hmm. our website.
I would love to do that because there's so many bills that require cultural sensitivity training for police officers. You know, in-house, in-service training. These bills help strengthen the police force, help keep police officers safe and the community safe, and really engage in developing a framework for trust building between police officers and the community. We've been trying, and again, being a member of the Appropriations Committee, I try to increase the funding every year for the COPS program. That's been cut tremendously, but community policing works. So we need more community policing. And so we'll send you a copy of the package of bills. But the CBC has been very instrumental in, again, not even before Ferguson, trying to move forward criminal justice reform and police reform so that, you know, we can have safer communities and the community and the police officers are safer and that we reduce the unbelievable onslaught of murders and shootings of young African-American unarmed men.
We are coming up on a break. Our guest is Barbara Lee, Congresswoman who represents the 13th District. And opportunity for those of you listening to talk with the Congresswoman. We've been talking about a wide range of topics, of course, about Cuba and relations, something that she's been very much involved in, about the Iran deal, about child care, about Ferguson now. And we'll certainly talk about AIDS, which is something else that's been very close to her heart and that she's been involved in with really just about every single piece of legislation. If you'd like to join us, you can do it now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Join us by phone, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with longtime East Bay Congresswoman Barbara Lee about a number of issues, certainly about Cuba, which is something she's been very involved in, about subsidized child care, about the Iran deal, Ferguson, about the presidential race, racial justice, and many other things. And you are certainly welcome to join the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You can also post questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. We've certainly got lots of calls and emails to go through to here. First, before we do, though, Congresswoman, like I say, you've been very involved in HIV and AIDS issues. You're part of the caucus and part of the funding subcommittee and so forth. And also not only looking at problems, big problems that continue, the I guess the fact is black gay men have the highest rate of any of the African-American populations. And global AIDS continues to be, I know, a major concern to you and on your front burner and so forth. So where are we? Maybe you can just give us a kind of brief sense of where we are and where we're going.
Well, I tell you, Michael, we're getting to an AIDS-free generation. The United Nations came out a report saying that by 2030, if we increase our investments in HIV and AIDS prevention, treatment, care, we will see an AIDS-free generation. What I worry about, though,
Excuse me, with 35 million now and 19 million who don't even know they have HIV?
Yeah, but that means we have to put more resources into public awareness so that we can have more people tested. We need to make sure that under sequester, as I said earlier, the Ryan White program, the Minority AIDS Initiative, PEPFAR, the Global Fund, we've got to increase our dollar amount into these programs because they're working. We've been able to save millions and millions and millions of lives in sub-Saharan Africa, here in our own country, here in San Francisco and in Oakland. But we see now a lull and we see budget cuts. And so what I worry about is that because of the lull and because it's not on the front burner, people are going to think that we've accomplished our goal of an AIDS-free generation. But we haven't. We have a long way to go. Many people don't know that they have the virus until they don't even get tested because we don't have enough in terms of our educational campaigns in terms of get tested, why to get tested. And so I think it's important.
Yeah, like I said, 19 million don't even know they're infected. I'm talking global now. Yeah,
globally. But, you know, and I have to share one experience with you. I was over in South Africa several years ago, and it was World AIDS Day. And they asked me to come to a rally of young people. They were trying to encourage young people to get tested. Now, I get tested publicly quite frequently because leadership is important. And I was on stage talking about the importance of getting tested. There were thousands of young people there, very reluctant. No one had lined up before. Well, after my speech and after I got in line to get tested, I turned around and there were lines of young people waiting to get tested. And the point is we need those resources and leadership to encourage people to get tested and try to help reduce the stigma. I co-chair the HIV/AIDS caucus, and this is a bipartisan caucus, and my co-chair is Congresswoman Ileana Ross Layton from Florida. So, you know, this has got to be an important issue to have a Barbara Lee and Ileana Ross Layton co-chairing an HIV/AIDS caucus of over 80 people. And part of what we have to do is reduce the stigma as it relates to HIV and AIDS. There's states now I was on the UN Commission on HIV and it was called HIV and the Law. And what we were looking at are laws around the world that criminalize people with the virus. And Uganda, you know, many countries are mounting this effort to make sure that people, unfortunately, who have the virus, you know, are isolated and stigmatized. But what I learned, and I insisted they have a hearing here in the United States, and we had one in Oakland, there are over 30 states in the United States that have laws on the books that were put on the books in the 80s.
These old sodomy laws and those sorts of things?
Well, if you have the virus and if you transmit it to another person knowingly or unknowingly, you could be arrested.
Yeah.
Those kind of laws. California has laws on the books. We're trying to get now members of the legislature to get the California laws off of the books. And so the United States, even though they may or may not be implemented. Some states do. Iowa, you know, we have cases from all around the United States where people have been put in jail, you know, and so the stigma is still there. And a lot of what we have to do is invest in making sure that stigma is reduced and that these laws get off of the books. So, yeah, it's a hard job, but we've got to remember that we haven't conquered HIV and AIDS, and we have to increase our resources into care, prevention, treatment, and testing.
Again, our guest is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. We're going to go right to your calls. Lots of emails, lots of folks with questions for the Congresswoman. We'll get to as many of you as we can. We begin, Blake, with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, what I wanted to ask, I was in Barbara Lee's district for many years, and I was always very proud of the courageous votes she made. But the one question I had, it's about the authorizations to go to war. and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not sure that I'm remembering this right, but I believe Representative Lee voted not to go to war in Afghanistan, but approved war or authorized the president to go to war in Iraq. Do I understand that correctly? And can you tell me what you were thinking, the justifications that she had for those votes?
No, Blake, let me just clarify this. I voted against the authorization to use force right after 9/11. I was the only no vote on that. I certainly voted against the war, the authorization to use force in Iraq. Actually, that resolution was based on the prior resolution that I voted against. And not only did I vote against Iraq, I know Leader Pelosi voted against it. And from what I remember, there were about 130-some no votes on Iraq. And I don't know if you remember the marches and rallies, but I was part of the thousands of people around the country, and especially in the Bay Area, who marched and protested against the war in Iraq. I have not voted for any authorization to use force.
What about Hillary Clinton's voting in favor of the Iraq war? I mean, does that bother you?
I think she subsequently has said that was not the correct vote. And I think that many people who voted against the authorization to use force in Iraq have said that that was not the correct vote. We've lost over 4,000 of our young men and women. There were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They misled the country. Unfortunately, Colin Powell went to the United Nations and misled the world. And I think a lot of members who voted for it are beginning to understand that that was not the right vote. And look at Iraq now. Look at what has taken place.
ISIS.
It's a no win. Yeah. I mean, this was the basis and the beginning for ISIS. And that was a very terrible war. And it was a terrible vote to use force there. So, no, I did not vote for it at all.
Candy, join us. You're on the air, Candy. Good morning.
Hi, Congressman Lee. I am a parent of a young adult son with severe mental illness. Currently, our mental health system is so broken, and many of those living with illnesses such as schizophrenia and bipolar illness are not getting the help they deserve, but instead are living homeless on our streets, cycling in and out of our psychiatric hospitals, and ending up in jails and sometimes even harming others because of the symptoms of their illness. I'm wondering if you are supporting Congressman Murphy's bill, H.R. 2646, Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, which is a major reform to our mental health system.
I have a mental health background. I actually founded a community mental health center in Berkeley in the 70s. I'm a psychiatric social worker by profession, so I understand exactly what you're saying. The mental health system is broken. We have achieved parity in the mental health system as it relates to insurance and benefits and what have you, but the model and the treatment and the priorities that we have put forth have not been supportive of mental health services. We can just look at, you know, what has taken place with your son, what's taking place. A lot of people who are in jail who should be part of the mental health system. And so Congressman Murphy's bill is a good bill. Hopefully we can get that passed. And there are other bills also as it relates to mental health services, but you're absolutely correct. We need to focus more and make it more of a priority. Hopefully, if we could get rid of what I talked about earlier, sequester, we can put more federal resources into the establishment of a really viable, good, strong mental health system, because we need to understand that many people need mental health services rather than being put on the street, being seen as criminals, and being ended up in jail or homeless.
What's the likelihood of getting rid of sequester, though, with this Congress? Let me thank you, Candy, for the call.
We're building support to get rid of sequester, and I think the president, fortunately, has put the word out very strongly that he's vetoing every appropriations bill unless we address sequester. Now, given the Tea Party and the fact that they want to dismantle government, which is their goal, is to get rid of government. It's really an anarchist type of perspective that they have.
So Ted Cruz approached the government?
Yeah, that's right. And we have a strong, hardcore 40 to 50 members of the House who believe in sequester, who believe the budget should be cut even more. Hopefully, Speaker Boehner, though, will listen to the more reasonable members of his party, such as, again, the chair of the Appropriations Committee says he wants to get rid of sequester. So I think there are many Republicans there who want to get rid of it if we could break this Tea Party control of Speaker Boehner, which is who he generally listens to. So I have to be cautiously optimistic because they're going to have to do something because the president, again, he's leading on this. And none of us are voting for I haven't voted for the appropriations bills at all. Most Democrats are voting no on appropriations bill because there is so far down under the levels that we would want to see that it will not only create more pain and suffering in the country, but it would also really shut people out of a pathway out of poverty and seeking the American dream.
I think Boehner has won some battles against the Tea Party, too, though. I mean, he's crossed swords with them.
Yeah, he has. And I hope he does with this because I think Leader Pelosi has been really phenomenal in pushing Speaker Boehner to that point where he knows that he needs Democrats to do anything that's rational in the country.
And we bring another caller on, and that's you, Melody. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Congresswoman Lee, I have a question about the war on drugs and the pipeline to prison, and if the Black Caucus is working on any kind of legislation or help for things like prison guards that need to be held accountable for murders that are happening, like the one in the prison in New York.
And thanks for that question. We're working on a variety of fronts as it relates to criminal justice reform, specifically war on drugs, pipeline to prisons. And I'll have to see if there's any federal legislation relating to prison guards. But a couple of things. One is we were able to reduce the sentencing disparity on crack cocaine from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1. It needs to be 1 to 1. But at least we got to 18 to 1 because, you know, it's primarily young African-American and Latino young boys who get who are incarcerated for crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. So reducing, you know, the sentencing disparity is being reduced, but we haven't been able to completely reduce it. Regarding the pipeline to prison, and I encourage people to read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. I'm rereading The New Jim Crow, and it really lays out what this pipeline to prison based on the war on drugs, what has happened in the African-American community. And that is new laws have been established that have been comparable to laws, the Jim Crow laws, for example. And we're trying now to get rid of some of those laws. Formerly incarcerated individuals, if you were put to jail, put in jail based on a drug conviction, you're permanently restricted in terms of eligibility for food stamps, for Pell Grants, for public housing. I can go on and on and on. And so we're trying to repeal that because people get out of jail, they can't vote, they can't get food stamps, they can't get public housing, they can't go to college because they can't get a Pell Grant. So what happens?
In many cases, people don't want to hire them because they have a record, too.
They have a record. Yeah. So I've led the effort to the president to ban the box, especially for federal contractors, to get rid of that box, you know, on employment applications. And so Michelle Alexander, in this book, The New Jim Crow, lays out what happened with the war on drugs and why it was such a popular war with not only President Reagan, but Bush and Clinton, what some of the terrible things that all of these administrations have done that really have created now the new Jim Crow. And so part of what we have to do is raise public awareness around this so that the Black Caucus and other members of Congress can move forward with these laws because we have the legislation that would repeal all of this and that would crack this prison to pipeline. But we don't have the public support yet for this. And that means getting to your members of Congress and telling them to sign on to these laws. So we're going to get, Michael, all of these bills and legislation that hopefully you will be able to help us work on by getting to your friends and colleagues in California and other states and telling them to get their members of Congress to sign on. And let's push this agenda.
Again, our guest is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. Let me thank Melody for her call. We'll go to more of your calls in a moment. I want to go to some emails, though. Emily writes, I just want to thank the Congresswoman for her steadfast commitment to our East Bay community and our country. Thank you for being a beacon of morality, compassion, and good old common sense for the rest of our country. It's a relief to hear a politician who truly does speak for all of us, regular people, and doesn't hide from hard issues, including race, class, and, of course, that heroic and historic descent after 9/11. Barbara Lee, you will always have my vote. Another listener, Mark, writes, big fan of Barbara Lee, hard to voice opinions and stand up for principles when those around you do not share the same opinions. And here's a listener who writes, in order to normalize relations with Cuba, don't we need to repeal the Cuban Adjustment Act of 1966? Otherwise, the entire staff of the Cuban embassy in New York is going to defect. Visiting ballet companies, jazz bands, and sports teams will continue to defect. And there is also the Kennedy-Khrushchev Pact, which ended the Cuban Missile Crisis. What is the status of that treaty? Doesn't that also stand in the way of normalizing relations with Cuba?
We can normalize relations with Cuba by ending the embargo, which requires legislation, which we're working on now. And that would, in effect, wipe out all of the Helms, which is really the Helms-Burton law that really institutionalized and codified all of these laws that you mentioned. So if we can lift the embargo.
Lifting the embargo would just wipe them out.
Would wipe them out. Yeah. And that's what we need to do. And lift the travel ban, because still there are certain restrictions on travel to Cuba. You can't go to Cuba as a tourist, even with the new executive orders. Of course, it's more liberalized now in terms of getting a license to go for specific purposes. But you can't just say, I'm going to Cuba to go to the beach to spend a week.
Here's a listener who says, our mental health system is in shambles, with those with serious mental illness now being institutionalized in our jails and prisons instead of getting medical treatment. Senator Murphy's bill, H.R. 2646, includes many important reforms. Will you vote for this bill, and will you stand with desperate families who cannot get help for their loved ones? I think you've already gone on record on that.
Absolutely, yes.
Another listener, Nafis, writes, Congresswoman, here in the Bay Area, we are facing a colossal transportation problem. Too many cars choking us with pollutants, one tunnel only under the bridge, and oldest train in the country, that is BART, small waiting stations, low frequency, lack of safety, and a very expensive fare. What better congresswoman in this era of global warming than you to secure funds to build a mass transit infrastructure that will alleviate the suffering?
I'm trying hard, because we have a transportation bill that right now needs to be reauthorized, and we're just doing this piecemeal. Every 2 or 3 months, we just reauthorize a few dollars to keep our transportation system going. This also, the infrastructure needs in terms of transportation creates jobs and economic growth. A couple of things I want to say, though. One is AC transit, public transportation is a must, and we have to have more resources, which I'm working on and continue to work on with AC transit. Bicycling lanes are very, very important. The first bill I passed when I was in California legislature was, it was an interesting bill. It was called AB, I hate this number, 666. Pete Wilson signed it into law. And what that did, and I was really proud of that bill because the bicyclers brought it to me and just wanted to increase the number of racks on AC transit buses so more bikes could be put in racks on the buses. And that's a really, it was really a very good idea. And so I think that told me and taught me how important it is to have bicycle lanes and alternative forms of transportation. And of course, BART, we need to expand BART as far as we can expand it, to BART to San Jose. You know, BART serves a very important role in terms of our transit system. But if we're going to get people out of the cars, and if we're going to really have a cleaner environment, we've got to deal with continuing to support the reduction of emissions. And we have to really look at alternative forms of transportation, build transit villages close to public transportation, and get people out of the cars. I'm fully supportive of that, and we'll continue to do that. But bottom line is we have to have this. Also, ferry service is another environmentally sound mode of transportation, but we have to pass a transportation bill. And again, the Tea Party is holding us up from passing a good comprehensive transit bill that would do all of the things that I mentioned and more.
Again, we're talking to Congresswoman Barbara Lee. Go to more of your calls and emails in just a moment, but I want to get something on the record here. Long as we've known each other, I did not know, and I can say this about many people I've known for many years, the story of your birth, but it is quite a story. And maybe you can just give us a little bit of that narrative. And this goes back to El Paso. We won't say how many years. But when you were When you were born, of course, it was a different era in terms of civil rights and Jim Crow and all of that. And tell a story. It's quite a story.
Thank you, Mike. I wrote this actually in my memoir, Renegade for Peace and Justice, and that's how I started it out. My mother, who recently passed, was a phenomenal woman. She passed in February.
And it's
very difficult, this period of grieving, because my mother was everything to me. She, and I'm the oldest of three daughters, we lived in El Paso, Texas, and my mother needed a C-section when she was pregnant and went to the hospital, Hotel Du Hospital in El Paso, Texas, and they wouldn't admit her into the hospital because she was black. And my grandmother, and you know the history of what has taken place in black community here as a result of slavery and the rape of women and what have you. My grandmother's father was Irish, so she looked, you know, she didn't look as black as my mother looked, even though my mother had green eyes. That Irish gene was still with my mother. And so my grandmother had to get into the hospital and say, look, this is my daughter. And they looked at my grandmother and, you know, she looked kind of white. They looked at my mother and they weren't quite sure, but they said, that's your daughter? And my grandma said, yes, 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 let her in. So they admitted my mother into the hospital reluctantly. And rather than take her in for a C-section, they left her. And my mother describes it as on a gurney in the hall. And no attention was paid to her at all. And this was because she was black. They just kind of put her aside. Well, finally, a doctor showed up or someone showed up and said, oh, it's getting late. You know, this is an emergency. You know, we've got to get her some care and we've got to get this C-section going. So they got my mother. They put her into the room, the operating room, and it was too late for a C-section. It was just no way they could do it for whatever medical reason. The doctors then at the last minute decided before, and my mother by then was delirious. She was unconscious. She was, you know, half dead, as my mother put it. And they decided to deliver me using forceps. And so they pulled me out and I had a scar above my eye for many, many years. And the point that my mother made to me in telling me the story of my birth was that, look, you almost didn't get here because of racism. Okay, you almost did not make it into this world, and I almost died, my mother. And so from day one, I knew what my life had to be about. One is women's health care, making sure no other woman had to go through what my mother went through just to deliver me a baby. And two, to make sure that black people had equal access under the law and equal health care and had a chance at living in America as an American citizen, because I almost didn't get here. And that's a matter of fact. And so my life, you know, some people ask me where I get the energy and why I keep doing what I'm doing. And I always say I have no option. My mother told me I better do this. And this is the circumstance of my existence, really, from day one.
Talking again with Barbara Lee, Joe in Oakland writes, Barbara Lee will always have my vote just based on her position against the authorization to use force. While there are many worthy programs that deserve and need funding, the budget needs balancing. Where would she recommend cutting?
I'd cut the Pentagon. First of all, we have, and I try to do this every year, it's a budget that's excessive. It has nothing to do with our national security. It fuels the military industrial complex. It's over $700 billion. And there's an OCO funding. It's the Overseas Contingency Account. That's a budget that's off budget. You don't even see that in the Pentagon. They use that as a slush fund. So every year I try to cut that. I think it's $36-37 billion. The Republicans have actually put it up to $80 billion this year. So
you're banging your head against the wall with those attempts.
I'm telling you, and this is a slush fund. You know, if they want to use OCO, if they want to fund these wars, then do it through the budget, so it's transparent and people know it. So that's the first thing I would look at, look at the Pentagon and try to get rid of that excess funding. Secondly, do you know the Pentagon has not been audited, and I'm trying to get GAO to audit the Pentagon. There's some requirements that the Pentagon be audited by 2017. Well, they haven't even started auditing the Pentagon. And believe you me, there's waste, fraud, and abuse in the Pentagon that could be used. Those billions of dollars could be used for early childhood education, for child care, for creating jobs, and for education, for a transit system, and for economic growth in our
country. How much money are we talking about, roughly?
out of the Pentagon budget, oh, I would say we're talking about $150 billion.
Out of the slush fund.
OCO is about $37-38 billion. Republicans wanted up to $80 billion, which, of course, they generally get their way. But the president's going to veto that. So we're talking close to $100 billion. OCO, Overseas Contingency Account.
It's not chump change, as they say.
It's not chump change. And here we have, here in California, and I want to raise this, Joint Economic Committee did a report on the status of black Americans. And in California, 26% of African Americans live below the poverty line. Unemployment rate is much higher, twice than what the general population is here in California. We're very close to Mississippi in terms of poverty rates in California. And so we're looking at a state where we have pockets of systemic poverty, where people, especially in communities of color, the African American and Latino community, could benefit from these resources that the Pentagon has, if we could use those resources to create jobs and to lift people out of poverty. And I have a bill, Pathways Out of Poverty, which would do just that. And we have to remember, though, that it takes our tax dollars to allow people the opportunity to live the American dream.
Well, we're going to have you back here because we got so many questions that we just didn't have time to get to. A lot of people bringing up Port Chicago. Maybe give us a quick sense of that, because I guess you spoke made a recognition of it in July, and there's something in the works to exonerate?
We're trying to exonerate those very brave African-American heroes who deserve to be exonerated from the stance they took with regard to the unloading of ammunitions at Port Chicago. Congressman Mark DeSaulnier represents the Port Chicago area and has been very forthright and very, I think, excellent in getting us to focus on why we need to ask the president to exonerate and provide awards, really, for these brave men, and their families deserve it. They deserve
it. Let's hope that comes to pass. We're out of time. So good to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.